On behalf of the faculty and the administrative staff, it is my pleasure to welcome you to this Founders Day service. We are pleased to have upon the campus today the trustees who are in the annual meeting of the Board of Trustees of this school. We have 30 trustees, 28 of whom are here. They have come, some of them, great distances to participate in the decisions to be made and to participate in the formulation of broad policies for the life and work of this school. I should like for all trustees to stand. Thank you very kindly. It is our great pleasure also each year to welcome wives of trustees who are able to come with their husbands to the campus. We should like for them to stand. If they are here, we welcome you. It is our very great pleasure also to have with us the wife of the distinguished scholar who will deliver the Founders Day address, Mrs. Ellen Easley. I should like for her to stand if she has come in. We welcome you with all our hearts. After the anthem, the Founders Day address will be delivered by Dr. J. Allen Easley of Wake Forest College. Dr. Easley is a native of Greenville, South Carolina. He is a graduate of Furman University and of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. He has done graduate work at Harvard University and at Columbia University. From 1928 to 1938, he was pastor of the Wake Forest Baptist Church and chaplain of Wake Forest College. Since 1938, he has served with very great distinction as professor of religion and for a part of the time as head of the Department of Religion of Wake Forest College.
Members of the Board of Trustees, members of the faculty, students, friends, I'm sure that all of you recognize that an introduction so gracious and so generous as that given me leaves me with a deep sense of appreciation and moves me deeply. One of the greatest blessings and delights of my life has been the friendship and association with the beloved and distinguished president of this institution. A Founders Day offers to an institution a peculiar opportunity to indulge itself in a backward look. Not as an escape from current problems, which are always clamoring for attention, but as an occasion for seeking in the past insight, for grasping that fleeting moment we call the present. As one of those who was at work on this campus in the faculty of Wake Forest College when Southeastern Seminary was begun, I take great pleasure in participating in this occasion, and I count it a signal honor to have been invited to do so. Furthermore, as one who for almost 40 years has been intimately involved in the life and work of one of our denomination's oldest colleges, I identify closely with this institution in its program, responsibilities, and endeavors. I rejoice greatly in your notable achievements, and I congratulate you upon developing in so short a time so excellent a theological school. As some educational institutions number their years, yours are few indeed, but they have been marked by high standards, dedicated service, and significant growth. Today, we remember with gratitude those who constituted the initial Board of Trustees and took the lead in opening the doors of this institution, giving to this eastern tier of southern states its first Baptist Theological School since the Southern Seminary was moved from Greenville, South Carolina, just about 100 years ago. Today, we hail with appreciation and affection the capable and personable Sidna L. Staley, your first president, and those who were at his right hand in the opening days. I vividly recall the diligent and indefatigable Joel Robinson, who moved to Wake Forest in the summer of 1951, opened an office in a room next to mine in the building you know as Appleby, and pounding his typewriter early and late, processed the student applications for the fall opening. Professors Leo Green, Berta Hips, William Strickland, and Mark Lovelace constituted the other members of the initial faculty, with Professors Olin T. Binkley, R. T. Daniel, E. A. McDowell, S. A. Newman, and M. R. McKay, and librarian E. C. Osborne added the second year. 102 students were enrolled the first year, and 249 the second. With good grace, faculty and students endured the inconvenience entailed in crowding a fast-growing seminary into a campus that was inadequate for the college that was still occupying it. To the founding trustees, the initial administration and faculty, and to the early students, Southeastern owes a great debt. Together, they gave to this seminary an impetus, spirit, and direction, which I am sure it will never get away from. Albert Schweitzer relates in his Out of My Life and Thought an episode of his young manhood. Seated among a company of men who had just come from a sitting of the academy, he heard one of them exclaim, "Why, we are, all of us, nothing but Epigone, the afterborn." It struck home with me, Schweitzer continues, like a flash of lightning, because it put into words what I myself felt. It is easy to see a definite link between this deep feeling of indebtedness to those who preceded him and the life he later lived at the edge of the forest of Lambarini. Furthermore, it was as an expression of this indebtedness that he called on Christianity to set itself right with its past, and especially with its founder, that it might become conscious of its true nature. Indeed, as one has recently put it, a people with no sense of the past has no genuine sense of the future either. Founders Day reminds an institution such as this of its status as epigonous in the essential meaning of this word as the afterborn, and makes it appropriately sensitive to its indebtedness to those into whose labors it has entered as heirs and successors. And here I think not only of those who were instrumental in the founding of this school, but also of those who through more than a century have built the total fabric of Southern Baptist theological education. And beyond them, all of those who with insightful mind, unselfish service, and deep loyalty to Christ, of a theological school. Immediately there comes to mind the simple reply to train the leadership of the Church of Jesus Christ. In founding seminaries, our denomination acknowledged that the churches could not themselves adequately educate and equip the ministers and other leaders whom they needed. It acknowledged that there is an intellectual understanding of the gospel, the church, and the world that is dependent upon prolonged and serious study, that there is a type of professional competence in Christian leadership that, as a rule, can come only through thorough training. The seminary naturally makes its prime address to its students, but beyond them lie the denomination, the local churches which the most of the students will serve, and the general Church of Jesus Christ, and beyond the Church of Jesus Christ, the explosive and chaotic modern world. The seminary can serve its students only in the light of the needs of the denomination, the general church, and the world. It seems to me that the late Richard Niebuhr made a helpful contribution to this subject a few years ago when in his book, The Purpose of the Church and Its Ministry, he defined the theological school as an intellectual center of the church's life. This does not mean, as Niebuhr was at pains to point out, that the seminary is the intellect of the church, but that it is a center of special intellectual activity, helping the church, as he put it, to express its intellectual love of God and neighbor, and to bring reflection and criticism to bear on worship, preaching, teaching, and the cure of souls. To lead the church to bring its mind to bear upon God, upon man, and upon itself may well serve as a more fruitful reply to our question of a few moments ago as to the obligation of the theological school. Many activities, diverse and far-reaching, are suggested by this term, intellectual center. The search for facts and reflection upon them, analysis and synthesis, discrimination and coordination, particularization and generalization, criticism and appraisal, diagnosis and prescription,
and so on, with all of the particulars involved in theological pursuit. These activities, concerned with God and neighbor and the believing community, have given rise over the years to an impressive curriculum apparatus for awakening, stimulating, and training students in the intellectual love of God and for preparing them for a professionally competent service. Seminaries are perhaps, in fact I'm sure, indeed, as well aware as any of us that their products are not always professionally competent. In fact, seminary men in our own denomination and in others are reminding us that mediocrity and incompetence in the ministry are all too common and all too well protected. As Dean George W. Peck of Andover Newton recently put it, in many a congregation, the minister is the only person who has no particular competence in any area of human knowledge or activity. We must press with urgency, he continued, our quest for a truly ministerial virtue or excellence, theological competence. End of the quotation. But there are services other than pedagogical ones which our denomination needs from its seminaries. Services that cannot be so readily structured as courses in Bible, in theology, in religious education, and the other disciplines. What are some of these denominational needs? I would like to mention three of them. First, the need generally on the part of the Southern Baptist constituency for a better understanding of the true nature of an educational institution of higher learning and the sort of atmosphere that is necessary for its life and work. There has always been, I suppose, a strain of anti-intellectualism among our people. Certainly, it was present at the founding of our early colleges and of our first seminary. And from time to time, in more recent years, it has found ugly expression in many ways. As when, not many years ago, before a meeting of the North Carolina Baptist State Convention, a prominent minister from another state, who was soon thereafter to serve for a number of years as president of the Southern Baptist Convention, launched an impassioned, vitriolic, and indiscriminate attack upon holders of the PhD degree. Many of our people have never clearly distinguished between an educational institution and an institution of indoctrination or propaganda, which hands out ready-made answers to well-tailored questions and seeks unthinking uniformity. Jesus, that teacher par excellence, instead of answering an inquirer's question directly and categorically, was fond of throwing it back to him, almost as if to say, it is not so important what I think, what do you think? It was obvious that Jesus was more concerned that the questioner's mind be filled with light than his mouth with words, even the best of words. Witness especially his encounter with the lawyer in Luke 10, the occasion for the story of the Good Samaritan, as you will remember. Furthermore, many of our constituency have never realized how little the search for truth has to do with consensus, and of how little value is the opinion of a man who has not examined the facts. A prospective teacher for a chair in religion in a Baptist college was being interviewed by a trustee committee. Their first question was, "Do you think your view of the Bible is in general conformity with that of our Baptist people?" To which the answer was given, "I do not suppose that it is. I have studied the Bible seriously, and most of them have not." This individual was ultimately employed. But the opening move of that interview betrayed a dangerous reliance on consensus and the unexamined assumptions of the rank and file. It is small progress, indeed, that any discipline, scientific, literary, or theological, can make on such a basis. It is only in an atmosphere of responsible freedom that true inquiry and real education can be carried on. Every denominational body that brings an institution of higher learning into existence should know this. Just as parents are given by the state to understand that there are limits upon their rights over their children, and that though they are free to create, they are not free to abuse or to destroy. So denominations should somehow be brought to understand that there are limits, moral if not legal, upon their right to throttle the life of an educational institution in the name of technical ownership and mass assemblies. The statement of principles subscribed to by the faculty members of our seminaries may not permit the freedom of a modern university, but these principles should be interpreted very broadly. The symbolic nature of language should be fully recognized, and the bona fides of administration and faculty should be generously accepted. Great latitude is a necessity of genuine intellectual work if it is to be done, if creative intelligence is to be brought to the service of the gospel and the believing community. Many of us are well aware of books in the field of biblical scholarship that were never written fully and published by Baptist theological professors because of the fear of an uninformed constituency. And more than one courageous seminary teacher, daring to put his researches in print and finding himself in denominational hot water, has been half seriously taunted by his colleagues with, "Didn't we tell you that the only safe seminary teacher is the man who publishes nothing?" It would seem that a constituency which makes so much of personal freedom and church autonomy as ours does, I should not have difficulty in believing in educational freedom as well. And it must be recognized that freedom in education is no guarantee of infallibility. Indeed, freedom must mean freedom to be wrong. For this is the only kind of freedom that is genuine. It is obvious enough that the growing edge of our modern life is largely in the realm of scholarly research and other high intellectual endeavors. If we Southern Baptists hope to contribute our share to the expanding structure in the service of Jesus Christ, we will have to get more concerned with the intellectual love of God and man, and we will have to loosen educational institutions from the shackles of consensus and majority vote in mass assemblies. Seminary professors, indirectly through their students and directly through their publications, their influence in denominational councils and assemblies, can help Southern Baptists to accept more fully the true nature of an institution of higher learning. A second point of today's need is for theological interpretation of the baffling currents of present-day thought. Many of our people, like many of the total national population, are in need of helpful insights into the implications for the Christian faith of loud and persistent voices that challenge many cherished positions. Science, with its searching light thrust into every cranny of our universe, and with its incredible expansion of knowledge, has discredited traditional worldviews. The welter of sociological and moral problems arising out of the population explosion, urbanization, automation, race and class struggles, wars that must not be lost but seemingly cannot be won, and the ever-present threat of a war that would end all, have left us bewildered with respect to many social values. Naturally, the believing community looks for a theological understanding of the disturbing facts and forces and turns for help to those with theological competence. A good example of the type of service needed from people with theological understanding was rendered in the midst of the evolution controversy in the mid-20s by a man whose former home is hardly 100 yards from this chapel, Dr. W.L. Petit, then president of Wake Forest College. Many devout people feared for the Ark of God, Southern Baptists prominent among them in that evolution controversy. Dr. Petit, an outspoken evolutionist, raised in a series of lectures at Chapel Hill the pointed question, can a man be a Christian today? To which he gave an illuminating and ringing answer, yes. His book with the title of his question helped many to find a solid footing for their faith. Furthermore, a denomination like our own, which prides itself on loyalty to the Bible, stands ever in need of a valid understanding of this book of books. And the hermeneutical task lies ever at the seminary's door. So it was in the days before it was common to raise critical questions. So it was when higher criticism became a burning issue. So it was in the height of the controversy between fundamentalism and modernism. So it was in neo-orthodoxy's attack on liberalism. And so it is now in this post-neo-orthodoxy time. The cry for a demythologized Bible, a new morality, a religionless Christianity, and a Christ without God faith should have much illumination from the theological school as intellectual center of the church's life. I am sure that our seminaries of today will not repeat the failure of our theological leaders of 75 or 80 years ago, when they declined to come to grips with the problems of biblical criticism, especially in the Old Testament field. Our fathers, though in so many ways our betters, suffered our people to flounder in a quagmire of impossible literalism for want of a forthright dealing with basic critical questions. Crawford H. Torrey, that pioneer American Old Testament scholar, was forced to leave the Southern Seminary, and the clock of creative Old Testament scholarship, as far as Southern Baptist was concerned, was stopped for 50 years. When Ralph Elliott sought to help start it again a few years ago, well, we all know what happened to him. Professor Shriver's recent volume on American religious heretics, with its excellent chapter on Crawford H. Torrey, that victim of a concern for consensus rather than the truth of the matter at issue, deserves wide reading. A.T. Robertson had better success in his grammatical studies in the Old Testament field, in the New Testament field, than Torrey had had in the Old Testament field. Perhaps it was because people were not so disturbed by Hockey's business and the enclitic day and other matters of that kind, as with Mosaic authorship. At any rate, with more than 40 books as a sort of byproduct of his grammatical research, Robertson helped to mediate his biblical understanding to the rank and file. Fortunately, for the past two or three decades, there seems to have been more liberty in dealing with matters of biblical criticism in the classroom than in publication. Unfortunately, however, seminary graduates are seen slow to pass on what they have learned in this area to their people. Langdon Gilkey, in his How the Church Can Minister to the World, and so on, has a pertinent word for ministers at this point. By their seminary training in the modern understanding of the Bible, in philosophy of religion, in theology, the clergy know well that the church, at least much of it, has long since abandoned its older beliefs in an infallible scripture, a miraculous world order, and a simple, literal understanding of Christian doctrine, which dominated evangelical Christianity formerly. When ministers talk together among themselves, there is a tacit understanding that neither the Bible nor Christian doctrine conflict with the new world of science, even though they may not feel themselves able to spell out a simple theology that can put the two worlds together. But do they announce this good news to their intelligent laity? Do they tell them that it is possible honestly to believe, as they themselves do, both in the validity of modern science and in the truth of the Bible and of central Christian concepts? Despite the fact that this is the major problem of all modern laymen, as earlier of each of the clergy personally, in general, the ministry maintains a conspiracy of silence on the subject of biblical criticism and the relation between a Christian concept and science. End of the quotation. When the list of more than 150 scholars from various Protestant denominations in this country and in England was being assembled to write the introductory articles and the exegetical and expository material for the Interpreter's Bible, why were there so few Southern Baptists on it? I could identify only two, and they quite outside the mainstream of Southern Baptist life. I am glad to note, however, that on the list of the 250 and more contributors to the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, there were a few more Southern Baptists. One of them, Southeastern's Mark Lovelace. But our total percentage was little, if any, higher. It is tragic that the largest denomination in our country, and one that makes its boast in the Bible, should have had an atmosphere so uncongenial to top biblical scholarship that when such projects as those just referred to were afoot, there should have been so few among us who could not be passed by. It is also tragic that a number of able scholars in this field, while once members of Southern Baptist churches, found the atmosphere so uncongenial that they left us. Scholarship thrives poorly in an atmosphere charged with suspicion of learning, an obsession with consensus, and the tyranny of a mass assembly. A third point at which light from our theological leadership is needed is that of denominational self-understanding. Constant examination, reflection, and evaluation need to be brought to bear upon the denomination's life, its emphases, and its activities. It is all too easy to concentrate attention upon favorite ideas and neglect unpleasant ones, to center upon points of strength and forget points of weakness, especially the weakness inherent in the points of strength themselves. For example, stress on mass evangelism fills up churches with people who are in need of assimilation and education in the foundation of Baptist understanding. But the heads of Baptist households take little responsibility for teaching their families the doctrines and moral standards of the faith. And Sunday school teachers and the authors of Sunday school quarterlies and even teacher training manuals often fail to deal forthrightly with matters necessary for biblical interpretation. Though we have multiplied our seminaries, it is possible that the denomination as a whole is less willing to follow theological leadership than it was when we had only one. So numerous are the poorly assimilated and poorly instructed converts in our churches. We have stressed the competence of the individual before God and the priesthood of believers. But we have never stressed the corresponding truth of the whole Church of Christ as a community of faith. For all too many of our people, the only really competent believer is the person who believes as they do. And the only real community is among those who share their denominational stereotype. Logically, it seems to me, Baptists should be the most ecumenical of all Christians. But actually, as we all know, Southern Baptists among the large denominational bodies are the least. Surely the time has come when we can afford to join in councils of churches, even if we have to begin timidly on the local and state level and to send only observers to national and world meetings. But so far, we have not even ventured to build a firm and unsuspicious fellowship with the American Baptist Convention. our conventions grow ever larger and larger, and yet seem reluctant to limit their jurisdiction, though they are obviously unable to examine all the facts pertinent to proper decisions. It seems difficult for people who have built their polity on the implicit assumption that one man's opinion is as good as another to trust fully the leaders, trustees, and other officials whom they themselves elect.